Hello, film lovers, and welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook. This show is available as a podcast, and you can also download it through iTunes. And we also have a blog, which you can get at
filmsociology.tumblr.com.
The man's voice you just heard, the man who likes Bailey's Irish Cream just as much as the next guy, Kobe Slagle.
Hello, hello.
Was that American Dad?
No, that was Bob's Burgers.
Bob's Burgers.
J.M. and I's favorite show.
Really?
Oh, yes.
I guess I'll have to watch what the popular kids are watching.
Gonna drink some Bailey's and unwind.
That's the Sunday night.
Yes.
Stretch of shows that are not Channel 20.
Yes.
Okay. But we do have something involving Channel 20.
Yep.
A little later on in the show, my chat with director Stanley Nelson, who directed the documentary Freedom Riders as part of the PBS Experience. That sounds like a band. The American Experience, which will air Monday night at 9 p.m. on just about every PBS station, including Channel 20. So we'll get to my chat with Stanley in a little bit. And let's see, what other shameless plugs? Oh, yes, The King and I, tonight, tomorrow night, and Sunday at 2:30 at, that's Footlight Musicals, 1847 North Alabama Street, that's 18th in Alabama. And then the next Friday, Saturday night at 8, and the next Sunday at 2:30. Meanwhile, and that is the first ever three-generation performance with my daughter and myself and my mother-in-law in the orchestra pit. Meanwhile, on the north side of town, northwest side of town, at Beef and Boards, it opened yesterday, Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella, featuring my beloved wife as the stepmother, the most beautiful stepmother in theater history. So, and that is running through July 1st. Okay.
Can I do another shameless self-promotion here?
Go, well, why not?
It's, you know, it's Friday. I'm having a pretty good day, and I think I'm pretty cool today, and my name's Kobe, so there you are.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's good. You know what? Because you can actually say library.
Yes, I can say library.
Well, there is one thing we know that you can do better than Tyler Hansborough, and that's read Chicken Little, which someday we'll share for you.
Yep.
And if you haven't heard it yet, find it. It's hilarious. All right.
You hear it here first, folks.
You did. Well, not really. Maybe. Okay, opening today, a couple of shows. There's the Judd Apatow-produced Bridesmaids. With Kristen Wiig, Maya Rudolph, and a bunch of other funny ladies. And director of Freaks and Geeks directed that as well. And not screened for press, but hopefully it looks ridiculous in all the good ways. Mm. The horror action film Priest with Paul Bettany and Carl Urban and Christopher Plummer.
Isn't Anthony Hopkins in that?
No, Anthony Hopkins is not in that. He is in Thor.
Oh.
Christopher Plummer's the other old white-haired dude that you probably confused.
Mm-hmm.
One being Welsh and the other being Canadian.
Yep, that'll happen.
That will happen with your generation. You know why? Because actors in their 70s, they performed in a different time. Oh, by the way, we will have an update on what is Kobe watching. We'll get to that. But opening in theaters, and this one has an actual local slant, and if you don't have plans tonight and you're not going to go see the King and Our Cinderella, I'll let it slide for now. But the documentary Dumbstruck.
But he's not going to let go of it. He's
I hang on to
it
like luggage. But the documentary Dumbstruck opens today, at Landmark Cinemas on Keystone in the Keystone area. And the filmmakers are going to be in person for tonight's 7 p.m. screening and then tomorrow's 4:15 and 7 p.m. screening. And this is one of these niche documentaries, I like to call it. If you are a fan of the documentaries The King of Kong, Fistful of Quarters, or Spellbound, Twisted, which was about the balloon artist. This time it's a documentary about ventriloquists, and it follows the path of four different ventriloquists in their careers.
Oh.
All meeting up with a yes, there is a ventriloquist convention in a small town in Kentucky.
Huh.
Where else?
Yep.
So we got a little epic version of the trailer for Dumbstruck, and here it is.
Mic check.
Check.
Check. Hey, check.
30 minutes, this place is going to be crazy with ventriloquists.
Hey, welcome everybody to the 31st Vent Haven Convention. What do you think of that?
A lot of times the vents are really isolated. Like, hey, I'm the only vent in my town, and they don't have anybody to talk to. So here, they get to talk to people.
Those cards arrive. It's going to be great. Shut up! Let's play cards!
I think I'm going all in.
Actually, quite a few ventriloquists who started out initially were quite shy and are still shy, and that's not an uncommon trait among ventriloquists.
I came to my first convention, and I just fell in love with the people. Everyone's so friendly, and everybody is like me, talk to themselves and play with dolls for a living.
Hey, Charlie, I'm running late to the show, but I do need you to help fix my dummy that his ankle's fallen off and I need little tiny nails.
I work full-time as a ventriloquist. I did 482 shows last year. I do the school assemblies throughout the school year, and on the weekends I do different shows with Bertha. I actually got my start in Miss Ohio pageant, and I was top five, and I got to do my ventriloquist act.
She really loved it. I thought it would kind of end as she got older.
Just,
you might settle down and get married.
Yeah, and have kids and instead of her puppet children. She just...
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dan Horn and Orson.
When you're a kid, you don't think about whether you're good or bad. You just do because it's fun.
Little Gary, say hello.
Hi.
I saw your mouth move.
Oh, hi.
And I was beat up a lot for being a sissy, but I didn't care. I liked it.
My name is Dylan Burdett, and I hopefully will be the next best ventriloquist.
He's been interested in it since he was five, so I can't ever remember a time when he wasn't playing with puppets.
I get along with most of my dummies, and my dummies don't seem to get along with each other, so.
I don't quite understand why Dylan picked a black figure to use.
Reggie, I guess he considers himself a pimp, you know.
The number one element to being a successful ventriloquist is you have to be funny to be good.
I can't walk very fast. I don't want to lay an egg.
Pretty much the rest of the family wants nothing to do with us. And they always tried to tell me to stay away from my aunt also, but I was in rough times and my aunt was the only one to help me out. So
I can say things through the characters. That if I said it myself, I'd be fired, I'd be slapped in the face or beat up. But they can say stuff and get away with it.
I'm going down to get drunk.
Actually, it's a God-given talent. The Lord was leading me into full-time evangelism, ventriloquism.
God left America.
Riding along on a carousel, trying to catch up to you.
Everybody, beware of the puppet mobile.
Horses chasing, cause they're racing. So neat, so far. On a carousel.
I have a picture of him dressed up as Zorro and me as Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Just a reminder, you can meet the filmmakers of Dumbstruck tonight at 7 o'clock and tomorrow at 4:15 and 7 o'clock at Landmark Theater's Keystone Art. I think I'm a sucker for the niche documentary series. And the titles I mentioned, Spellbound, which was about the kids in the spelling bee, King of Kong, A Fistful of Quarters.
Ball Hawks.
Yes, Ball Hawks, that's right. We talked about that. The guys who are outside Wrigley Field as they chase foul balls or home runs, and King of Kong, which is about the video game competitions, and these guys. Everybody has a story, I guess. That's probably what appeals to me, is that everybody has a story to tell. Some more interesting than others, and that's all right. And one of the producers is a Lawrence Central grad, so Mark and Lindsay Goffman are going to be in town as a part of this. And as you heard, the five stories you have is you have a former Miss Ohio beauty queen who is steady, Kobe, and who's doing 500 shows a year. 500 in a 365-day year.
That means more than once. Yeah.
Yes, it does. Wait, good counting, Wilt. So you have that. You have the 13-year-old kid who wants, who is trying to break into the business, and one of his main characters is a black pimp, not Sweet Daddy D, like Jeff Dunham's character, although I bet they could hang together.
I could see that.
You could see that?
Yeah.
Very cool. Then you have the guy who works the cruise ship circuit, and apparently that's a big thing to get on, to latch on to, is they pay well, you travel, you always have a gig. The guy who winds up winning America's Got Talent and winds up getting the biggest contract in Vegas history. 5 years, $100 million. That's like Wizards money.
That's crazy.
That is crazy, but pretty comfortable. And then there's Wilma, who at one point was a man, became a woman, and family disowned her, except for her nephew, has financial trouble, and winds up getting a stronger family bond with other ventriloquists than she does her actual family. So really good stories. You get the follow. I mean, the film's under 90 minutes, and maybe because you concentrate on five of them, you know, you get a good chunk of their story. I think you get emotionally attached to them watching it. I know some people, I don't think anybody in the studio, that mannequin or you know, clowns and ventriloquist dolls are a bit unnerving for some folks. Not me, even though there've been films like Magic and Devil Doll, which, and I asked the kids film correspondent, you know, do mannequins or do ventriloquist dummies scare you? And she goes, only the ones that try to kill you. So I said, good. So she's all right with those.
I can't do clowns.
You can't do clowns?
No.
I understand that.
But ventriloquist,
Emma and I have talked about this. It's, you know, the constant smiling expression. It doesn't help John Wayne Gacy was one and kind of put a damper on the whole image of him.
Yeah.
And yes, this film does not contain any Jeff Dunham or Nina Conti, although I do recommend checking out some of Nina Conti's work on YouTube. Not right now, Kobe. Later. After you look at Miss Ohio. So, anyway, it's fun. It's enjoyable. And these are real folks, and they got a story to tell, and I think it's worth sharing. So definitely go check it out.
Now that was a good movie.
Just a reminder, the filmmakers are going to be at Keystone Arts tonight at 7 o'clock, and then tomorrow at 4:15 and 7 o'clock. Okay, moving on. Now that we're in the midst of a blockbuster season with Fast Five and Furious Five and
Five Furious,
all the others, and Thor, of course, opened last week.
Thor with his pecs.
Yes, his big six-pack.
Yes.
Probably an eight-pack if you're in a Keystone light. Also opening up today, at least in Indianapolis, is the drama or the dramedy. Not Dramamine. Oh. What?
It's a dramedy?
It is a dramedy, because there are some funny moments in it.
Oh.
It's called Everything Must Go, and it stars Will Ferrell in a rare dramatic role, although he's done them in the past. Stranger Than Fiction.
I like that.
Winter. You did. Mm-hmm. You actually saw a strange. Wow.
Yeah.
So I'll cross that off the list. It wasn't on the list. And Winter Passage, and Will Ferrell plays a man who just really had a bad day, losing his job, his sobriety, and his marriage in one really crummy day.
The company has decided to make a change.
I've given 16 years of my life to this company.
The rest of the higher-ups wanted you to have this. That should just about cover it.
I'll give you $10 for that twack right there.
Aren't you a little young to be drinking beers?
Aren't you a little old to be drinking that slippery there?
Hi, are you in there? If you are, can this happen another day?
So are you getting rid of your old stuff?
I got fired from my job and my wife left me.
If I'm honest, I saw this coming a mile away.
Thanks for warning me.
Gotten some complaints about someone living on their lawn.
This is my corner. I'm not leaving my stuff.
City of Arcadia allows a property owner to hold a yard sale for no more than 5 consecutive days. This buys you 3 days.
I was thinking you might want to come work for me. Stay here, maybe sell a couple things.
What are you offering?
I'll give you bathroom and cigarette breaks as required by state law.
I don't smoke.
Good. Great.
Standing at the door of self-discovery.
You know, you can't live like this.
Why not?
It's not normal.
How much for this?
You want to buy that? 50 cents?
I'll give you 25 cents.
Yeah, I just can't do that.
What about these?
I think I want to hold on to those. They're actually pretty valuable.
You can put them in that same drawer.
Okay, so hold on. Look at them.
Once you get rid of all that stuff, you're going to feel great.
Just wanted you to know, I'm selling it. All my stuff. That feels pretty good.
Are we friends?
Yeah, I guess so.
The other kids make jokes. They say, you're so fat, you got shocks on your toilet seat.
That's mean.
You have a good heart, Nicholas. That doesn't change.
How much have you had to drink? In my opinion, not enough. You're gonna have to come with me.
I want to learn to play baseball.
Why don't you want to play soccer?
Black people don't play soccer.
Whole continents of black people play soccer.
This is based... Wow. Sorry about that. That was not Kobe's fault. We blame the trailer. This is based on a short story by Raymond Carver called Why Don't You Dance, which was published in 1981. And this is not the first time Will Ferrell's done something dramatic. There was a period where I broke Will Ferrell films down into two categories. The films where he does and does not run around in his underpants or less. Old school, Talladega Nights, so on and so forth. And I think this comes at the right time because I know, well, his last couple films have not done incredibly well. Of course, Land of the Lost. Hands up if you saw it. That's what I thought. You saw it, Kobe? You and Abdul are two people I know that have seen that film.
I didn't like it.
You didn't like it?
Nope.
Were there other people in the theater with you?
Yeah, it was actually a screening, pre-screening.
Oh, a pre-screening. Well, of course, they'll go for it if it's free.
Yeah.
And you enjoyed Danny McBride in that?
Yes.
Okay.
You gotta love Danny McBride.
Yeah, in all sorts of ways.
Yep.
Don't wear the American flag like a cape. All right. Back to this. I think it was good timing for Ferrell to do this. And oh, the other kind of dramatic. Well, it was a comedy, but it was subtle. Was the Woody Allen film Melinda and Melinda that he had a role in that. And a lot of people have been saying that this is his Punch Drunk Love, and it's not as good a film as Punch Drunk Love, and I loved Punch Drunk Love, and I love people who get irritated by Adam Sandler in Punch Drunk Love because he's not, you know, singing off key with a guitar and falling and yelling, and am I wrong?
I have not seen it.
No, that's right, but a lot of Sandler's films follow that.
And talking in this voice.
Yeah, that's great. Anyway, back to this. It's a subtle performance. Ferrell is allowed to do some funny stuff, but I like it when, especially apparently the SNL alumni, actually have to follow direction, actually have to do something other than just let the camera roll and let's find out what happens.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sure there's a blooper reel. Maybe there will be on this one. I'd like to see it, but some other familiar faces you got in here and voices: Stephen Root, Michael Pena, Rebecca Hall, Laura Dern. Really nice scene with him and Laura Dern, where they were friends in high school. She doesn't even remember what she signed in his yearbook, but it really meant a whole hell of a lot to him. One of those encounters.
Uh-huh.
I hope you don't get one of those. but I'm hoping more people see this. You know, it's probably going to be just playing the art cinemas and that's about it. And it might get washed over in the summer blockbuster season. And since Will's last summer film, which was Land of the Lost, he had to make a different change. He had to do a different, go in a different direction. And I'm glad he did on this one.
Mm-hmm.
Go check it out.
Now that was a good movie.
Okay. We're going to take a short break and we're going to come back with some DVD and Blu-ray titles. However, the musical breaks. Now, normally people ask, it's usually the theme from Blackula, and the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. But tonight, we're going to do something different. We're going to pay tribute to actress Dolores Fuller, who died recently at the age of 88. She died this past week. And besides being known for the films of Ed Wood, which I'll talk about in a little bit, but she was also credited and uncredited for writing several songs for Elvis movies. That's right. And guess what? I've seen these. I've heard these. Thank you to my mother. Thank you to my daughter. So we're going to take a short break. Here's Elvis doing Rockahula Baby from Blue Hawaii, and I didn't even have to look at the notes. I know where that's from. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org.
She moves her hips up to her fingertips, I feel I'm heaven bound. And when she starts to sway, I've gotta say, she really moves the grass around. Rock, a hula baby, rock, a hula baby got a hula loop from Honolulu, that rock a hula baby of mine. Kiss my little hula miss, I never get the chance. I want to hold her tight all through the night, but all she wants to do is dance.
Are either one of these any good? Sir?
What?
Are either one of these any good?
I don't watch movies.
Well, have you heard anything about either one of them?
I find it's best to stay out of other people's affairs. You know who I can do without? I could do without the people in the video store.
Which ones?
All of them.
What would you get for a 6-year-old boy who chronically wets his bed?
So do you have any new movies in?
Do you have that one with that guy who was in that movie that was out last year?
They never rent quality flicks. They always pick the most intellectually devoid movie on the racks.
Ooh, Navy SEALs!
It's like in order to join, they have to have an IQ less than their shoe size.
Just go open the video store.
Yeah, open the video store.
And the video store is open. Welcome back to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msoci@WFYI.org. And I'm also on Facebook. Kobe Slagle's hanging out with me.
Yep.
We're going to be hearing an interview with director Stanley Nelson in just a little bit. Of course, he's the director of the PBS documentary Freedom Riders, which is part of the PBS American Experience. You can see it Monday night at 9 o'clock here on Channel 20 and other PBS stations. How long is that interview?
What, yours?
Yes.
Hang on a second.
Can you check that for me?
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to get through a couple of DVD titles before we break into that. 21 minutes?
Yep.
Okay, good to know. Just had to double check that. Sorry, folks. I love when we do technical stuff on the air.
We're on the radio.
As it happens. Yep. Okay. New on DVD and Blu-ray this week is a film that was nominated for one Academy Award. Probably should have gotten a couple more, but what are you going to do? It's the marital drama Blue Valentine. It stars Ryan Gosling and Michelle Williams. And, of course, Michelle Williams received an Academy Award nomination for this one. A lot of people said Gosling probably should have as well. But it's a drama about a marriage and their 5-year-old daughter. And, the marriage is just falling apart. And he's stuck in a rut and doesn't mind moving. She wants to have a better life, and he kind of likes where he's at. And the film also cuts between the modern day and when the two characters meet each other. And even though it seems blissful watching it, you can see little signs that just lead to, well, as my daughter once said when watching Hamlet, this isn't going to end good. And, well, I'll let you figure that out. I'm a big fan of the films of John Cassavetes, films I might make Mr. Slagle watch sometime soon. Films like Woman Under the Influence, Faces, Many a Moskowitz. And it feels improvised, but it's not. Well, that was Cassavetes. In this one, we heard a famous story where the two actors and the girl lived together for a month before filming. Nice to have that much commitment and that much time.
Yeah.
So I don't think I could do it. I know my wife couldn't. And you have other things to do as well. So, but not a date film. Don't take a date to this. I've been married 12 years, and my wife and I watched this together, and it was still a gut-wrenching experience from that part. But it is really well acted, really well done. If you enjoy seeing really solid performances, and really Michelle Williams and Ryan Gosling are two really smart actors who make pretty interesting choices. They're not making Land Lost, at least hopefully never. And they really, really work well together. So rent it, and I'd even say buy it if you're one of those types.
Yes.
Also opening on DVD and Blu-ray this week is what I think should have won Best Animated Feature at this year's Academy Awards. Take that, Toy Story 3. But it was also a film that would have made my top 10 had it actually come to Indianapolis in 2010. It's called The Illusionist, and it's from the same people that gave us The Triplets of Belleville. And it's a beautiful and at times really sad story, hand-drawn animation. That's always a plus, about an aging magician who's just trying to carve out a living, going from gig to gig. He winds up getting a female companion who is going to be a mentor. He's going to be a mentor. Is she going to be a protege? Well, you'll soon find out. And this has a very distinct note for me in my family, because I took Emma to go see this, the kids' film correspondent, so she could see something that wasn't Pixar, something that wasn't Disney, something that wasn't a Hollywood animated feature. She saw it, she loved it, and this is the only film so far that both of us cried at the same time, at the same moment. I won't tell you when. You're going to have to look for it yourself. Yes, I do admit to crying on film sociology. Take that. So, anyway, I know it played in town, I think, for a couple of weeks. Not enough. Go rent it. Go buy it.
Yes.
Now we come to a film that I have to be careful to talk about, because I know mentioning this film will make my engineer and producer slightly queasy.
I hate this man.
I know you do. It is the romantic comedy No Strings Attached, starring Academy Award winner Natalie Portman and Demi Moore's husband, number two, Ashton Kutcher. Yeah. I love just the mere mention of his name.
He's terrible.
Brings booze.
He is just awful.
You don't get his humor, do you? You don't get the punked?
No, I don't get the
If
punked.
You don't get it, I sure as hell don't get it. That's her. Yes, it's basically, yes, they play two people who have had a bad track record of relationships, and they're going to have lots of sex without any emotional ties. Well, guess what, folks? As time goes on, you can fill out the rest of that sentence. You're a smart lot. The film is, and I hate to say this, I hate to disappoint you, it's not the worst film in the world. In fact,
might you say it's...
Yeah, it's not hella bad.
It's not hella bad.
But it's also not...
Because it's garbage!
I will
Would say... Would you say that...
I'm just saying, it's snoozable.
I love it when Kobe has fun playing with the new toys at the show.
I had another one.
You had another one?
Yeah, keep talking.
Okay, I will. This being said, it's not hella bad, because I've seen Kutcher play more obnoxious characters in other films.
I feel like he himself is obnoxious.
Butterfly Effect and Killers. Killers last year made my worst 10. Yeah, it was bad. And Portman, you know, she gets to do a romantic comedy. Well, wouldn't you, after having to, you know, do all the stuff that you went through in Black Swan?
Yeah.
Anyway, and like a romantic comedy, they have to surround the two leads, because whether they're funny or not, but you have to surround them by a funny supporting group. There's the cute Indian woman that was in The Office. Kevin Kline plays Ashton Kutcher's dad, who is an aging former television star who winds up sleeping with his son's ex-girlfriend. Kobe just rolled his eyes. Sorry. So, and Carrie Elwes shows up briefly, but doesn't do a whole hell of a lot. So it could have been hella bad, but it's
oh, hang on. I had another one loaded here.
What?
Yeah, it's not hella bad.
Going back to The Killers, you might say. Oh, dang it.
Yes, that's unfortunate.
No excuse for that.
But this might... We got that one, right? We got that as well?
Okay, you gotta get rid of the tail of that.
Oh, I like that.
But no, but the two of us? Yeah, okay. All right. So, to add further injury, Kobe...
What?
I'm going to give you a list.
What?
And I think you're going to know what this has in common. Ready? Brittany Murphy.
Oh.
Tara Reid. Amy Smart. Zoe Saldana. That's Uhura from Star Trek. Mm-hmm. Amanda Peet. Melissa Sage Miller. Cameron Diaz, Michelle Pfeiffer, Jessica Alba, Katherine Heigl, Natalie Portman. What do these ladies all have in common?
They were all in a movie with Ashton Kutcher.
You just verped in your throat, didn't you? Sorry, dude. I know. So,
he's...
You just don't get him.
No.
You don't get him.
I don't get the punk.
You don't get the punk? Now, worse than Dane Cook?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Worse human being than Dane Cook?
Definitely.
I say, because I think Dane's films are far worse.
I say, I've not seen any of Dane's stuff.
I have. That's why I sit here. Remember, I see films so you don't have to?
You don't have to.
Oh, awful, yep. Awful. All right, let's move on. So we got some titles that came out on Blu-ray. And some of these are definitely worth checking out and possibly buying. Or you can send them to me. Thank you.
You can send them to me, too. I'd like to get stuff.
Do you have a Blu-ray player?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you do?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-oh.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see. What is Kobe watching? Might have to add to that Netflix account. All right. New on
Sosie Flix.
That's right, Sos Flix. New on Blu-ray this week, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Fun Western with Paul Newman and Robert Redford. Might have to add that to your list as well.
I would like to see that.
Very good. Speaking of downers, this is a great double feature with Blue Valentine, John Huston's The Misfits. The last film with Clark Gable, the last film with Marilyn Monroe, one of the last films of Montgomery Clift, Eli Wallach, 95, still with us, still rules. but a really good drama about an aging Bronco Bucker and falling in love with Marilyn Monroe, who was very good but also very sad in this. Also on 20th Century Fox's Blu-ray list, Patton with George C. Scott. Shouldn't have won Best Picture. That should have been MASH. Of course, George C. Scott won the Oscar for Best Actor and turned it down. Also on MGM Blu-ray, Some Like It Hot. Very, very funny film, of course, with Jack Lemmon, Tony Curtis, Marilyn Monroe, and Joe E. Brown. Men in Drag is funny. Ask my wife. She's got two of them in Cinderella.
Ah.
At Beef and Boards, yes. The two ugly stepsisters are played by men.
Ah.
Hi, Doug. Hi, Jeff. Criterion Collection has put out the Jonathan Demme comedy Something Mild with Melanie Griffith, Ray Liotta, and Jeff Daniels. And also on MGM Blu-ray, the original Terminator, now that, you know, certain somebody is out of office and apparently out of a marriage. And also on MGM Blu-ray, The Usual Suspects.
All right.
Which we cannot quote.
Yes.
Well, we can quote, just not those lines. So,
man.
All right, we're going to take a short break, and we're going to hear my chat with director Stanley Nelson. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point, WFYI.org. We're going to play you another Elvis song written by Dolores Fuller. This is from the 1965 musical epic Clam Bake. Here's Do the Clam.
Everybody gather round, listen to that bongo sound. Grab the first one in your reach, now we're gonna shake the beach.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Do the clam, do the clam. Grab your barefoot baby by the hand, turn and tease, hug and squeeze. Dig right in and do the clam. You can't get your heart to spin on the outside looking in. Moon ain't gonna last all night. Well, let's work up an appetite.
Yeah, yeah.
Do the clam, do the clam. Grab your barefoot baby by the hand.
That's right, from 1965. I'm sorry, that's from Girl Happy. You know, the Elvis movies, the musicals from the 60s. They, you know, they bleed into each other after a while. That's Do the Clam, written by Dolores Fuller. We'll talk about her a little bit after the interview. Just a reminder, this is Film Sociology. I'm your host, Matthew Sosi. Stanley Nelson, the director of the documentary Freedom Riders, is going to be airing on PBS Monday night at 9 o'clock as part of the American Experience documentary series. And the last time Mr. Nelson was in town, I was able to sit down and talk to him about the film, his Indiana connections, and some documentaries and stuff that he has to watch with his kids, because I can relate in that way. Here's my chat with Stanley Nelson. Joining me on Film Sociology is director Stanley Nelson, director of the American Experience documentary Freedom Riders. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great.
Now, as I find out, you have some Indiana roots. Tell us a little bit about your Indiana connection.
Well, my mother is from Indianapolis. She was born and raised here. Her father, F.B. Ransom, was the attorney and business partner of Madam C.J. Walker. I believe there's a Ransom Place in Indianapolis. It was named after my grandfather.
Not to be confused with Peyton Place. That's a whole other story. You should go to the Walker Theater and get your desk. So tell me about the first time you heard about the Freedom Rider movement.
I kind of knew the name, like so many people. I kind of heard it. I might have had it confused in my head with the Hilary Swank movie.
You just took away one of my snappy remarks, so that's fine.
So I might have had it confused with that. It's like so much of the civil rights movement. It was kind of a blur. I knew the iconic pictures, but if you had asked me, what the Freedom Riders were and asked me to kind of delineate it, I probably would have gotten it totally wrong.
Now, for those who don't know, and we want you to see this as well, but give folks a little overview about the Freedom Riders.
The Freedom Riders was the very beginning of the civil rights movement. It was in 1961, and 12 people, 6 blacks and 6 whites, decided that they would test the segregation laws of the Deep South, and they would do that by simply getting on Greyhound buses and Trailways buses, 6 on Greyhound, 6 on Trailways, white and black mixed, and they would all sit together in the front of the buses, white and black together. They would go in the bus stations and eat in the restaurants together. The white people would use the colored-only restrooms. The black people would use the white-only restrooms, and they would just kind of see what happened.
And according to some members of the South, Armageddon.
Yeah. I think they no way expected what finally did happen. I mean, I think they expected that, they would meet a little bit of resistance, but nowhere near what finally happened to them.
So it started with 12. Can you tell us a little bit about some of those 12 people, and were you able to talk to the original 12?
Of the 12, I mean, this is 61, so it's 50 years ago. So half of them, I would say, have passed away. The other, there's probably 6 or so who are actually in the film. They were very young. A lot of them, some were college students, and those people, are still around. So we were able to talk to about 6 of those original people.
A little tougher threshold when you're in your late teens, early 20s, I would think.
Yeah.
How did it expand? I mean, and how long did it take for it to expand? Because I know numbers I saw were even in the mounds of 400, not to mention some off branches of the Freedom Riders, which we'll get to in a little bit.
Well, it's just an incredible story. So the original 12, one of the buses gets bombed outside of Anniston. They actually plant a bomb in the bus and then hold the doors closed and try to actually burn them alive. The other bus goes on into Birmingham, where it's arranged with the chief of police there, Bull Connor, for the Klan to have 15 minutes to, as someone in the film says, to burn, kill, maim. I don't give a goddamn what you do to them. You got 15 minutes to do whatever you want. And so they're very, very badly beaten, and they can no longer go on. At that point, a group of students from Nashville just hears about it, on the radio and in the news that this group can no longer go on. And that same day, this group of college students from Nashville get on another bus and head down to Birmingham to continue the Freedom Rides.
And they were mixed as well?
They were mixed as well.
Now, and I assume everybody had different backgrounds, different class systems, everybody with one common goal in mind.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things that's so fascinating about the story is the first group of riders, the first group of 12, they were young, they were old, they were white, they were black, they were students, they were non-students. There were some who were from the South, some from the North, just a mix of people. The next group of about 25, 30 are from Nashville. They're all students in Nashville, and they had been part of what's called the Nashville Movement. They had integrated, segregated lunchrooms and movie theaters already in Nashville, and they had already kind of been part of the Civil Rights Movement, the very beginnings of the Civil Rights Movement in Nashville.
Can you tell us, give us a little bit of background on CORE, the Congress on Racial Equality?
Yeah, the Congress of Racial Equality was one of the civil rights movement, was one of the groups in the civil rights movement. They tended to be more confrontational than the NAACP or the Urban League. They believed in direct confrontation. So they believed in, you know, to not only picketing, but, you know, to go into stores. They were segregated in what's called direct confrontation, although they were strictly nonviolent.
Okay, I was saying, that takes away the Malcolm versus Martin method of...
Right, they were strictly nonviolent. That's one of the fascinating things about the Freedom Rider movement, is that it was totally nonviolent. So as these as the Freedom Riders were getting brutally beaten, they were in no way fighting back. They were just covering themselves up, but in no way were they fighting back.
Now, while this is all happening, what's going on in Washington?
Well, you know, this is the first year of the Kennedy presidency, and Bobby Kennedy is the attorney general. And the Kennedys just wanted it to go away. I mean, they did not want to be involved in this. They were elected, part of their way they were elected, John F. Kennedy was elected, was through a coalition of southern states. So he was really supported by the southern Democrats and, you know, didn't want to tick them off. And so he really just wanted to try to ignore it and did not want to become involved. And that's, in the film, that's one of the kind of side stories that's going on throughout. So the story is working on a lot of different levels. You have the Freedom Riders on the ground, on the buses, but then you also have the story that's taking place in Washington.
And I think a lot of people always assume, link Kennedy to the civil rights movement, and, well, history says otherwise at times.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the surprising things, I think, about the film, is that, you know, this is, again, it's the beginning of the civil rights movement. You know, John Kennedy is not the John Kennedy that he later becomes.
This is not the first time you've done documentaries on human rights. I think of Wounded Knee and, of course, the murder of Emmett Till. Did you approach it differently as a filmmaker? Granted, they're all documentaries, but I wasn't sure.
Well, I mean, I think every film is different. I think one of the things about this film was we decided early on that we wouldn't have narration, that we could probably make this film without narration, which is, you know, an incredible step for a filmmaker. So that kind of colors everything afterwards that you do, because you know you're not going to have narration to kind of back you up, to connect A to B or A to C. But I think what it does is it gives the audience a much more visceral understanding and a much more visceral connection to the story, because there's no voice from on high telling you what to think or telling you what happens next. A lot of this story, you know, you make the connections yourself.
So when did you start working on this particular film?
Let's see. We started probably in 2009, in the middle of 2009. It took us about 18 months to finish the film. The film has been done for a little over a year. We premiered in Sundance in 2010, and we've done a couple of festivals and stuff since then, but we've really been just kind of waiting for it to air.
Well, I would say, how many folks did you interview for this, whether it made the final cut or not?
We probably interviewed somewhere around 35 people, I think, and maybe 30 made it into the final film.
Were you able to get in touch with any public officials from the South at that time?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the greatest things in the film is that the governor of Alabama, at that time, Governor John Patterson, is still alive, and he's in the film. He's in the film in film clips back then, but he also gave us a great interview now. So it's just an incredible piece, and he's very, very honest about, you know, what he was thinking and what he did and why he did what he did.
Because it reminded me a little bit of when you saw George Wallace in Four Little Girls, although that one was a slightly different tune being played.
Yeah, I think it's always incredible to hear from those officials, you know, nowadays, to hear, you know, what they were thinking and what was happening back then. I mean, Governor Patterson was one of those kind of seminal, you know, racists back then. You know, he's in the film clips talking about, you know, the Freedom Riders and in some ways spurring on the mobs that continually assault the Freedom Riders.
Now, a lot of people said that this was the first major victory in the civil rights movement. What happened after this?
Well, the result of the Freedom Rides was that the signs in the bus stations and in the restrooms and the restaurants were taken down. Finally, the signs that said colored only and white only, as someone says in the film, for the first time in generations upon generations, those signs were taken down.
Now, the signs were taken down, but was it still enforced?
I mean, yeah, it actually was. What's really is incredible about the Freedom Rides is that, you know, the CORE went down a few months after the signs were taken down, and they found that they actually, that it was enforced, that people could go to any bathroom. You know, there's only one bathroom. People could go into the lunchroom. They, you know, you could sit wherever you wanted on the bus. That after all this craziness that happened around the Freedom Rides, once the signs finally came down, once the federal government finally spoke, that it was fairly easy to make the transition.
So you said it premiered at Sundance. When did you get in touch with PBS?
Well, you know, this is a film for American Experience. So
right.
Really, it's the other way around.
Oh, I'm sorry.
American Experience got in contact with me. We had done a number of films for American Experience, as you named Murder of Emmett Till and Wounded Knee in Jonestown. We're all done for American Experience, and they contacted me, I guess, about 2 years ago or so, and said, you know, we've got this book called Freedom Riders. We want to take a look at it. And, you know, I don't think I didn't even hang up the phone because I didn't want them to call up anybody else and say, so would you also take a look at the book? I just said, yeah, let's go. This is great. Send me the book, but I already know that it's a story we should do. And I think one of the reasons why is because I think it was really exciting to have the chance to take one event in the civil rights movement and really dissect it. You know, I thought that was just an incredible opportunity.
Now, I know you just got into town, but I wasn't sure if you knew of the 1968 experience at the Historical Society. We have a thing where when Bobby Kennedy was here the day Dr. King was shot, and there's a memorial at the park where he spoke, and now there is an exhibit at the Historical Society going on right now. So I don't know how long you're in town.
Yeah, I know. I'd love to see it. I know the film footage of Bobby Kennedy
at
speaking that day. Actually, my wife, we worked together for years, has always wanted to do a film about 1968 because it just was such an incredible, incredible year.
We'll call American Experience. They call you. So just curious, what were as a filmmaker, what were some of the first films or even first documentaries that really piqued your interest?
You know, it's really funny. One of the first documentary that I think I ever saw, you know, besides the ones that they made us see in school.
In the AV Club.
Yeah, right.
Now Mystery Science Theater fodder.
Those horrible, horrible films we saw in
right.
school. And I'm from the day of 16mm where, you know, the film used to get stuck in the projector and burn. And
every 45
like that.
Seconds.
Yeah. Well, we liked it at school because they turned off the lights, you know, and that was fine. But I think the first film, for some reason, you know, I was about 16 or 17, and me and a friend were walking down the street, and they were showing a film called The Murder of Fred Hampton about the Black Panther.
Yeah.
And for some reason, we were walking down the street, and the film had already started, and we just went up to the guy at the booth, and we said, the film's already started. We don't have any money. Can we go in? And he said, yeah, go on in. I don't know why we did it. I don't know.
Never
happened
today.
One of those things, you know. And so we just went in and saw this movie, and it was just such a different experience. It was seeing history told. It was seeing a different history told in a different way.
What year did that come out?
This might have been, it would be hard for me to say. Maybe 68, 69.
Okay, so
this is like before.
You know, the Fred Williamson, Jim Brown movement of cinema.
Yeah. Now, this was actually a documentary about Fred Hampton. And it's really funny because one of the projects that we're working on now, trying to raise money, and I think it's actually going to happen, is a two-hour film on the Black Panther Party.
Well, I know they just put out a feature film about some members of the Panthers. I think it's a fictional film.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Night Catches Us.
Thank you. So when did you start filming, whether it was at home or, professionally?
It was one of those funny things. I got a camera. I was a little interested in filmmaking, and I was 15 or 16. I got a Super 8 camera for Christmas, and I, you know, I used it a couple of times.
Sure.
Anybody who knows Super 8 film, it knows that it's not easy to use Super 8 film to edit and stuff. It's really thin and small, and I used it a few times, but I didn't really use it a lot. And, you know, then I was in college, and I was kind of bouncing around college, and I thought, you know, let me take a film class. You know, let me just see. You know, before I give up doing something artistic. Let me take a film class. And I did, and I liked it. And I realized, you know, this is cool to me. You know, if this is all I have to do, if I can go and see films and write about films, and then we got into producing and editing, I loved it. You know, I didn't mind shooting all day and all night. I didn't mind having to report at 5 a.m. I didn't mind editing, you know, all night, Saturday night. I kind of liked it, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's how I got into it.
Do you remember the film you made for your class?
Sure, I remember every single film I ever made.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, tell us about it.
Yeah, the first film I think the first film I can remember making was a film. There's a song by Dizzy Gillespie called "Hey Pete, Let's Eat More Meat." And it's kind of a funny song, and actually, you know, they're singing, "Hey Pete, let's eat more meat." And we went and we shot all these people eating meat, and we eating hot dogs and hamburgers, and we shot in a packing plant. We shot like big sides of beef swinging and sides of pork swinging in the thing, and it was just like a real kind of little funny film that we did.
Maybe one of the first early videos.
Yeah, I guess, you know. And I was interested in music and how do you use film and music together? So, you know, probably if you took any film that I've ever made, at some point, you know, somebody sings. We get people to sing while we're doing the interviews, you know.
Well, I'd say go back to Freedom Riders. Tell us about some of the music you were able to use for that.
Well, we were able to use great music from the civil rights movement. You know, just incredible music. I guess part of the greatest thing, and probably one of the decisions that really makes that film work, is there's a song that we found was actually written by Bayard Rustin, a famous civil rights movement organizer, who wrote a song called "Hallelujah, I'm Traveling," and it was actually about the Freedom Rides. But the way and the only recording we could find was he sung it. And he sung it very operatic. He's like, "Hallelujah, I'm a traveling. Hallelujah, ain't it fine?" And it just didn't work for the film. Mm-hmm. And so I said, you know, we have a composer we're working with, and I said, he said, "I got somebody. I got a woman who has a great voice. Let me have her sing it." And she sung it, and her voice had all these kind of, you know, flourishes and trills and everything in it, and it just sounded, you know, too much. It was too much. And I said, you know, try it again and have her record it like she's on the bus and it's 2 a.m. and she's her head's up against the window and she's just singing to herself. And he had her record that again, and it just was like crazy. And so that's the ending of the film, ends on that song. We use her kind of humming the song, I think, twice in the film. We use her singing the song in the beginning as they start off on the rides. It's really something that really makes the film work, I think.
Who is she?
You know, I can't remember her name. Because I know that sounds horrible, but I work with the composer. He's in Boston, and I'm in New York. And with modern technology, we do everything on the phone and through the Internet. And so I never met her.
If we get an email from her, well, I'll let you
know. Yeah, please. And I'm really looking forward to finally going to a screening in Boston where she's there so I can hug her.
and tell her you forgot about her in Indianapolis.
I'm not going to tell her that.
It sounds like a song lyric, really. Well, it's something interesting. When it comes to music and documentaries, it always seems like that's the documentary filmmakers come with hat in hand. As far as, you know, because that can be, you know, rights for a song can be the entire budget of a film, you know, feature films is something else different. But it seems like some of the most generous times musicians can be is when a documentary filmmaker asks them and hopefully connects.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we've had great luck, you know, with musicians. If you can get to them, you know, usually, you know, you can work out a deal. I mean, sometimes it's really hard, you know, because with music for a film, you have to get two things. You have to get the sync license. You have to get the performance license. And I think the sync license belongs to the company. So, you have to deal with Sony Music and, you know, or somebody like that. And they're notorious. I mean, they it's not worth their time to even look at your request.
Right.
So what we do, and we have a woman who I've worked with for the last 20-something years as a music supervisor. She says, you know, okay, it's Sony Music. Just put, you know, $2,000 in the bank in escrow and just keep it there because, you know, they're not going to answer. And they don't. They'll answer like, you know, literally 9 months later. You know, you'll just get a thing and they'll say, okay, that's send me $2,000 and we'll do it.
And not only that, but occasionally you might have to run into the musician themselves who sometimes maybe want cash.
Right, right. But musicians, you know, you can work with. Musicians, you know, you can usually work with. It's the big companies that
right.
where it's just not worth. I mean, their lawyers are making, you know, it's not even worth their lawyers' time to read it.
Pick up a phone, it's $400.
No, right, it's not worth it.
So I know you have twins, you told me before the yeah. show. Now, how's the give and take when it comes to watching movies in your household?
They win all the time. it's no contest.
You try?
100% of the time.
But what have they forced win. You to watch recently?
They win. We were watching. They've gotten into Ocean's 11, Ocean's 12, Ocean's 13.
Oh, the Soderbergh ones.
Yeah, and those Ludlum things. What are they?
The Bourne
Identity.
Yeah?
You know, I mean, and that's better than it was, because before it was always just the animated. Whatever it was, the animated. Sure. And then they got into about a year and a half ago, it was any kind of sports movie, you know.
Really?
Or any soccer movie. Well, they play sports.
Oh.
So it was any soccer movie, any baseball movie, any foot, you know, like the corniest, worst one. It didn't matter, you know. They love them.
And you, of course, comment on the side from the expert in the house.
No, I just sit there and watch. I just make some popcorn and watch.
Did you give them Dramamine when you watched the Bourne films?
No, actually, we watched the first one, which is
not
as bad as the other ones.
And that's really frustrating. Of course, the same director did Bloody Sunday, which I think was one of the best films to come out that year. And I don't remember getting nauseous watching that one.
No, I know when I watch one of those Bourne movies, the last one or two, I like count the shot. I count how long the shot's on, like 1, 2, 1, 1, 1, 1, 2, 1. You know, and actually, I'm looking forward to watching that with my kids, because, you know, it's something that I could show them about film, to say, watch how short these shots are.
I think you should show them a Cassavetes film.
Yeah.
75, 76, 77.
Or Ken Burns.
Well, Stanley, thank you so much for hanging out with us here at Film Sociology.
No, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
The documentary Freedom Riders can be seen on Channel 20 this Monday night at 9 p.m. Couple of quick obits. Actress Dana Winter died at the age of 79 last week, and 7 months after her co-star Kevin McCarthy died, she was the female lead in the original 1956 Invasion of the Body Snatchers, directed by Don Siegel. She also appeared in the film Airport, and as I said earlier, actress and songwriter Dolores Fuller died at the age of 88, best known for such Ed Wood classics as Jailbait, Glenn or Glenda, and Plan 9 from Outer Space. Also films like The Blue Gardenia, Count the Hours, Playgirl, The Raid, and Bride of the Monster. Not in Plan 9 from Outer Space, but Bride of the Monster. So, and, of course, played by Sarah Jessica Parker in the Ed Wood film directed by Tim Burton. So there you go. Ladies and gentlemen, we need to give you some closing words, some words that you must live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Don't forget King and I tonight and tomorrow night at 8 o'clock and Sunday at 2:30 p.m. at Footlight Musicals, 18th in Alabama. And then next Friday and Saturday night and Sunday afternoon, Cinderella at Beef and Boards featuring my wife, the King and I featuring myself, my daughter, and my mother-in-law in the orchestra pit. On behalf of Kobe Slagle, go see a good movie. You deserve it. You're listening to WFYI 90.1. HD to the point. This is Film Sociology. You can also hear it on WFYI.org.
We go!